Support for the Marketplace Money podcast provided by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, providing the financial expertise that helps both our members and our communities thrive. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com.
Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. So what have you spent your hard-earned money on recently?
I bought some barber clippers at a beauty shop.
I bought a pair of True Religion jeans.
I think I bought a really nice leather jacket.
Mostly food.
A couple martinis.
I bought a sofa from IKEA.
Eventually, most of it ends up on the trash heap, doesn't it? Well, sometimes consumer spending is good.
Economically, to keep money flowing and people getting jobs and everything.
Sometimes it's bad.
I'm a shopaholic.
And sometimes?
Yeah, it's ugly. My walk-in closet is about 3 refrigerators.
How long can this keep going on? In the next hour, a look at what happens to all that consumption after we're done with it, from cash register to landfill. Is it up to us to curb our voracious appetite for stuff, or should we simply find more places to toss it away? It's all coming up on Consumed, a special report here on Marketplace Money. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Today we present a special report called Consumed. The series airs all week on this and half a dozen American public media programs. We're exploring whether our consumer culture is sustainable. On Marketplace Money, we're looking at the end of the consumption chain after corporations manufacture and market all those products to us.
I get disgusted looking at catalogs where there's so much frivolous stuff. Your grandparents used a marshmallow on a stick. It wasn't like this fancy self-rotating, s'mores machine.
Where does all that junk on which we spend our hard-earned money eventually end up? The landfill. The EPA says Americans generated 245 tons of municipal solid waste in 2005, double that of just a generation ago. Today we'll look at both the problem and some unorthodox solutions.
We're salvaging food that is not garbage, and we're finding a way to consume what shouldn't have ever been put in the trash in the first place.
And we'll follow the trail of trash around the globe.
Shipping old corrugated boxes from Los Angeles to China is actually less expensive than shipping them from Los Angeles to Las Vegas.
I'm Tess Vigeland with Marketplace Money's Consumed Special. Get ready for some trash talk from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive on the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
It's trash day in Pasadena, California, my town. Here in front of my house, and block after block, the streets are lined with green garbage bins, blue recycling bins, and black bins for yard waste. It's pretty much the same across much of the country. 4.5 pounds of trash per day, per person. And no wonder. To consume more and more every year, we have to toss last week's stuff away. But where is that away place our trash goes? Well, first, of course, it goes into the garbage truck. I hopped a ride with my integrated waste management representative a few weeks ago. Okay, we'll call him the garbage man. John Willis doesn't mind.
You okay there?
All set?
All set.
Show how we roll, baby.
As we roll along, I tell Willis that our question of the day is, what exactly is wrong with trash? The rest of us live with it. He lives it.
Well, there's nothing right or wrong, really. I mean, it's a fact of life.
True enough, but it's become vastly more so over the last 4.5 decades. Since 1960, America's population has grown by 60%, but the amount of garbage we generate has grown 180%.
All right.
Willis says he's seen that happen on a smaller scale on his route. More and more trash over a quarter century of collecting Pasadena's debris, scrap, slop, and other waste. He's been going by my house for the last 15 years.
All right, here we are at my house.
Yeah, your cans are nice and well-spaced. Plenty of room.
Thank you, we try.
Okay, you haven't lived there that long, huh?
No, about 3.5 years.
Yeah, I got my barbecue from that house. She brought it out to the curb and she wanted to somebody to take it, you know. So I said, well, you know, it looks in pretty good shape. I'll take it. Took it home, and I'm still using it today.
John does a lot of curbside recycling on his route, as well as filling the recycling bin at home. He's convinced that the rest of us want to do the right thing, too, as long as it's not too time-consuming. And national figures suggest he might be right. Recycling, including composting, kept some 80 million tons of trash out of landfills in 2005. That's a giant leap in just a couple of decades. But Willis has noticed that people play fast and loose with their definitions of what's recyclable. He's found everything from dead animals to a boombox and speakers in recycling bins.
I don't know how people think a boombox would be recyclable. So ridiculous. I used to do yard waste. And I swear people would think if it's outside in the yard, it could be thrown out. So they put hoses in there, statues and pots, you know.
I do.
He laughs, but still wonders whether anybody ever thinks about where all their discarded junk is going or what happens to it when it gets there, like turning into greenhouse gases. Landfills are the largest human source of methane in the U.S. We don't see the methane, but we don't really see the trash either after it leaves the curb. It just kind of disappears. I asked him whether that makes it easier for all of us to just keep buying and consuming and then tossing our stuff away.
I don't think so. We will run out of space. How we deal with it may be more of the question we need to address.
Here in Los Angeles County, half of our landfills are slated to close in the next decade and a half, including the largest one in the country, Puente Hills. They'll all be closed by 2053. Okay, so none of us can throw anything out ever again. After a morning driving around my small neighborhood, John and I headed to the nearby Shoal Canyon landfill, the final resting place for my trash. If you're imagining a picture of the old town dump, that's not even close to what's really here. Shoal is a modern landfill high on a sagebrush-covered hill with a view clear to the ocean.
They'll probably end up making a golf course out of it.
In the end, we'd picked up 5.5 tons of garbage. It took less than 30 seconds to empty that load onto the day's pile at the landfill.
Well, have you had enough?
I think I've had enough trash for the day, thank you.
I will take it home, man.
So that's it. That's the journey of my trash.
That's the beginning and the end.
So where will the garbage story end? Tough question, he says. We're always going to have it. You can't consume things and not produce waste. So what can you do? Later on, we'll profile some folks doing their bit to eliminate waste by eating it. Recycling's another option. Maybe get that old DVD player fixed instead of chucking it for a new one. But as we'll hear in a moment, the demise of the fix-it culture is making that choice less and less viable. We've got photos of John Willis and my trash tour at marketplace.org. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by Reuters, delivering news and information that reaches over 1 billion people every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters.
A couple of years ago, our DVD player went on the fritz. We looked into getting it repaired, but it would have cost about $150. We could buy a new one for less than $100. Where'd that old player end up? At a nearby hazardous waste drop-off site. When did fixing things get more expensive than buying the new version? We asked Marketplace's Sean Cole to investigate the demise of the fix-it culture.
One thing I love about my town, Arlington, Mass., is it's kind of stuck in the 1950s. There are all these mom-and-pop businesses here, including an actual five and dime, lots of barber shops with names like Joe's Hairstyling, and a surprising number of repair shops. One of them is right around the corner from my house, Sanford's Camera Repair. It's run by a guy named Ed.
Hello. Ed, yes. How are you?
Good. Nice to meet you.
And just a few blocks up the street is David's Shoe Repair, which is run by another guy named Ed.
Ed?
Yes.
And they have a lot in common, besides being named Ed. For one thing, they were both featured in the same newspaper article, which is now hanging up in both their shops. Headline, The fix is in decline.
So how's business?
It's down.
Ed Plakovich is the camera repair shop manager.
The repair world is shrinking. Certain shops have given up. They just can't take the low volume. And we're lucky that we don't have too much competition in this area.
Their niche is fixing film cameras, old ones. But that's not what keeps the shop afloat.
We had to get into the digital cameras because otherwise we wouldn't have enough to keep us going. So that we were forced into it. Kicking and screaming, you might say. But
kicking and screaming?
Because it's expensive to buy all the equipment and send the technicians for training and that type of thing.
Up the street, the other Ed, Ed Soloway, at the shoe repair shop, has diversified as well. He's doing a lot of orthopedic work now.
What we did with this one is we put in a lift, somebody that has one leg shorter than the other.
And he started fixing stuff that has nothing to do with shoes.
The other part we're trying to develop is the sports repair. I do all types of hockey repair, baseball glove relacing.
Soloway says straight-up shoe repair was a big industry two or three decades ago, but it's been fading.
It used to be years and years ago. There used to be, you know, multiple people working in shops. And
not anymore.
No, you know, with the advent of disposable stuff.
Stuff that costs less but also breaks sooner. And because it's so cheap, it just feeds into this vicious cycle of buy, throw away, buy, throw away. A cycle that both Eds know well.
It's gotten to the point where many of the smaller cameras are not worth repairing.
Shoes are made in a way that's disposable, you know.
These days.
Sure, you know, they're molded soles. You know, they're made so that they're not always repairable.
So if our repair charges are, say, $125 and it sells for $135, of course, you can't convince anyone to have it repaired.
Plus, when was the last time you thought about getting a digital camera fixed in the first place?
It's a lens barrel.
Or a pair of shoes, for that matter. When was the last time you even passed a shoe repair shop? And if I was a Harvard professor, I would have phrased that last sentence like this.
How many cobblers, as they are traditionally called, can one find walking in neighborhoods?
Stephen Gracer is a marketing professor at Harvard Business School.
Now, that doesn't mean one can't find a place to get shoes repaired. It just means that it's not part of walking down the street in a lot of places.
And in a throwaway society, if you have to go out of your way to get something repaired, you're probably less likely to do it.
Time is a cost. So you have to go there. You have to park there. And then you have to wait or come back. So you put that all together and you ask yourself, is it easier to say, you know, it's time for a new one?
The question is, which came first, the lack of available expertise or the lack of demand for repairs? Stuff still breaks, but somehow we've all, as a society, stepped away from the proverbial fix-it shop. But there is one factor that may trump all this economics: sentimental value. Whether you're talking about a camera or a pair of shoes or a piece of sporting equipment.
You get a glove. I did a glove that was like a guy's father's glove, and he gave it to him. His father died, and just something to remember him by, you know, and he wants to keep the glove in good shape. So I restrung the glove, and, you know.
And maybe that's not enough to keep an entire Arlington, Massachusetts worth of repair shops in business, but it's something. I'm Sean Cole for Marketplace Money.
After the break, we continue with our special program, Consumed. We're dedicating the entire show to the question of whether our consumer culture is sustainable and what happens at the end of that consumption chain, the landfill. At least one group of New Yorkers is doing everything it can to keep trash out of landfills, including munching on ground cover at a city park.
Like this, about a million plants there, and I have no idea what the name of a single one of them is. And now it turns out a lot of them are things you pay $4.99 a pound for down at the supermarket.
That story and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. We're back with more of Consumed on Marketplace Money, a special series on this and other American Public Media programs. I'm Tess Viglund. So what's wrong with trash? That's the question we're asking this week. We've already heard how we're running out of landfill space. Well, believe it or not, more than 10% of that trash is food. A University of Arizona study found that each of us throws away more than a pound of food every day. Half a hamburger here, an unused container of sour cream there. So let's explore some solutions to the overconsumption problem. How does a late night trip down Third Avenue in New York City sound?
Hello, everybody. Welcome to our trash tour.
That's Janet Kalish. She's the tour guide for our group of garbage gourmets.
We're in front of a popular chain supermarket in Manhattan in the East Side. I encourage people to take as much as they like and more, because otherwise they'll end up in a landfill, and I'd say just take as much as you can possibly carry.
Don't call the cops. I'm not with a gang of shoplifters. Kalish is a high school Spanish teacher who lives in Queens, and she's part of a small but devoted movement that calls itself the Freegans. Every few nights, members in New York City hit the streets under cover of darkness to rifle through industrial-sized black garbage bags left curbside for pickup.
We're salvaging food that is not garbage, and we're finding a way to consume what shouldn't have ever been put in the trash in the first place.
Do you ever get concerned about the quality of the food that you're taking from the streets?
What concerns me is that the quality is so high.
Here's what the group found in the first 10 minutes of the search outside a store near 38th and 3rd.
Here is styrofoam-packed pre-cut carrots, because we can't cut our own carrots anymore, apparently.
That's 29-year-old Adam Weissman. As we talked, he carried a large fax machine found abandoned on a nearby corner. He planned to repurpose it for his office. You might call him one of the fathers of freeganism here in the U.S.
Here we have one of the gorgeous ironies, organic lettuce packaged like a Sherman tank.
I'm just astounded at this pile of beautiful-looking bread.
Multiply this by all of the bakeries, the pastry shops all throughout the city. Every single day, they're all boasting that it's made fresh every hour. How can they do that? By throwing it out. Do you eat buttercrisp?
Yeah, I do.
You like some?
Salted.
The group gathered cartons of not-yet-expired eggs, boxes of butter, plastic-wrapped broccoli and celery. From outside, the celery looked wilted, but removed from its packaging, just one stalk had gone bad. The rest was perfectly edible.
Does anyone want the yogurt? Last call.
These stores are doing something that we all do on a much smaller scale. Every time we clean out the refrigerator or the pantry, how long do you keep milk beyond its expiration date? That study we mentioned earlier says American households toss out $43 billion worth of food each year. 15% of that waste either hasn't expired or is never even opened. But if dumpster diving isn't the solution for you, there's another option just over the Brooklyn Bridge.
Anyone that doesn't have a bag, because I have some extra ones.
Tim Keating is also part of the Freegan movement, but instead of foraging through garbage bags in Manhattan, he leads foraging tours through Brooklyn's Prospect Park, where the food is off the path, under your feet.
I know it seems odd, but in the city, I find almost any area with plants growing, you're going to find something edible.
Keating leads about a dozen converts and the curious onto a grassy, weedy hill just inside the park's north entrance. He says he started wild foraging when he was 13, so he knows what he's looking for and reaches down to grab an example.
This is very, very common, and it's really, really good. It's one of my favorite greens. It's called lamb's quarters or wild spinach. Some people call it pigweed.
He points out the unique characteristics of the plant's leaves, talks about its nutritional value, and then offers some suggestions for home cooking. Try it raw or sautéed.
To me, it's really indicative to see that all you have to do is step in off the pavement and you're surrounded by four or five things that are really great to eat. This is called plantain. And
as the group wandered through the park, I asked one visitor, Steve McFarlane, what brought him out.
Like this, about a million plants there, and I have no idea what the name of a single one of them is. And now it turns out a lot of them are things you pay $4.99 a pound for down at the supermarket.
Of course, that $4.99 goes to pay for the packaging and shipping and marketing of your organic dandelion greens. But is urban foraging really a rational solution to our overconsumption habits? Or is it just a little kooky? Back in Manhattan, I put that question to Freegan Adam Weissman.
No, I don't think I am kooky. I think our culture is, frankly, insane.
What kind of impact do you think you're having by going through garbage on the street and picking out day-old bread?
Individually, what any one of us chooses to buy or not really isn't going to make a difference. I mean, we see that here. If we don't buy the product, it's going to be wasted anyway. But what we're trying to do here is model an alternative.
What do you think about people like me who don't root through garbage for their food? I buy a lot of things I don't need that I simply want.
Well, I think the question for all of us is simply to ask questions with every consumption choice we make. not necessarily to feel this well of guilt over how we've lived our lives, but to ask ourselves, how can we continue to live our lives?
If you'd like some ideas about living your life with less waste, in more conventional ways, log on to our website. We've got some useful links, as well as photos of the Third Avenue Trash Tour and the Wild Foraging Tour in Prospect Park. It's marketplace.org. Click on Consumed. Up next, from Third Avenue to Madison Avenue, is it possible to get off the consumer marketing grid?
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
The Freegans are trying their best to close their eyes to our consumer culture. But just because they aren't paying attention to Procter & Gamble's most recent marketing campaign doesn't mean marketers aren't paying attention to them. Marketing and advertising is a $500 billion global industry. A lot of that money is spent collecting information about you so salespeople can target their pitches to your interests. So we sent Marketplace's Steve Henn out to try and fashion a modern-day invisibility cloak. What would it take for him to hide himself and his family from the global marketing machine?
Once or twice a month, I'll come home from work to find my daughters reading a toy catalog like it's a storybook.
Can I see?
Ads aimed at my little girls are dropped into our home every other day through the mail slot. My kids became demographic targets before they could talk. Now they make collages of their material desires.
Cut it out, Ella.
I'm gonna try to cut out Dorothy.
It's enough to make me wonder if escape is even possible.
If you truly wanted to escape, you're going to expend a tremendous amount of effort, and it has to be on an ongoing basis.
Beth Givens at the Privacy Rights Clearinghouse says there are things you can do. The biggest is to opt out of direct marketing at every opportunity. Refuse to allow information about you to be sold or shared from company to company. But it's laborious. Ari Schwartz from the Center for Democracy and Technology says there are different rules in different situations.
Right now, it's kind of industry by industry.
One call gets you on the do not call list. Another can eliminate most direct mail. But other industries, you have to contact companies one by one. For example,
financial institutions that you do business with might be selling your customer data to third parties.
So to disappear, I'll need to start dialing 800 numbers. SunTrust for my checking account, a congressional credit union for my car loan, my mortgage company, Bank of America for a credit card, TIAA Cref, Charles Schwab, maybe Fidelity? And we're just getting started.
Unsolicited credit card offers, did we talk about that one?
Nope, another call.
And then don't fill out product registration forms, consumer surveys, and then when you subscribe to a magazine, tell that magazine company, do not sell my name.
Your pharmacist could be part of the matrix, too. Some pharmacies have signed contracts with big drug makers to market you new drugs directly.
It deals with the relationship you have with your doctor. To turn that into a marketing opportunity, I think, is diabolical.
Even public schools sometimes make information about their students available to marketers. Information gathered through surveys, fundraising sales, and student directories. So if I'm going to disappear, I need to opt out at school, too. But my efforts to get off all these lists can be undone in a heartbeat just by doing something as simple as filling out a change of address form.
The post office does share change of address information with the top, I think, 20 companies that have really, really large mailing lists.
And those 800 numbers I dialed to get off the lists? Gotcha.
When you call an 800 number, the recipient of that call is able to capture your phone number. And then if they pay extra, they can actually find out the name and the address and other information about the person attached to that number.
Talk about a catch-22. And even if you don't mess up, disappearing completely is still unlikely.
Public records are a gold mine for marketers.
Remember those toy catalogs my daughters read?
Hey, where's the mango? Faye, what's that?
The costume I want to wear.
Well, chances are marketers found out about Faye's very existence by looking up her birth certificate. So from the day you're born, marketers may have your name. In some cases, you can pay them to stop sending you ads. But even that's not so easy.
They've actually made dead people pay.
Ari Schwartz at the Center for Democracy and Technology says the Direct Marketers Association won't do much for free.
You know, if someone said, I want to take my dead father's name off the list, and they said they made them pay a dollar.
Schwartz says death, taxes, and junk mail are the new certainties of modern life. Unfortunately, junk mail can follow you beyond the grave. I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace Money.
If you want specifics on how to make yourself anonymous to marketers, head over to our website. It's marketplace.org. In a moment, more of our special series, Consumed, the product of a year's work at American Public Media. It was also a year of abstinence from consumerism for one family. Imagine 12 months without buying anything new. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Steve's story makes it abundantly and depressingly clear how tough it is to get yourself off the marketing grid. The consumer culture is a powerful force. Sometimes, like the Freegans, you have to get super radical to challenge that force. Meet the Mullins.
We made enchiladas and quesadillas. And
they're a typical middle-class family of four living in the bedroom community of Daly City, California. Stay-at-home mom Angelique is 36. Her husband Terry is 38 and works as a stagehand. Their daughter Daphne turned 5 this year, and their son Henry turned 1-year-old. The Mullins are members of something called the Compact, a group of people who vow not to buy anything new for an entire year, except basic necessities like food and toothpaste. We decided to follow them through the year to see what it was like. Here's what Angelique told us back on January 3rd.
I feel really good about it. I feel excited about it. It's a challenge, and I think that's one of the things that appeals to me about it.
We next spoke in March, and the Mullins were staying strong.
It's going very well. We haven't had any problems so far. Not too many challenges either. We've been okay. I might be having a little bit of withdrawal starting now, but... I think, what can we do? Maybe we'll go shopping. Oh, wait, we can't do that. We can't go shopping. So then I remember, and I don't even know what I would want to buy. So it's not like there's anything urgent we need or want.
By mid-August?
We're still doing it, but I am really feeling like I'm ready for the year to end. I'm ready to stop.
What's been the hardest part?
You know, the thing is, it's not even that I have anything that I specifically want to buy. It's just the fact that I... can't, or I said I wouldn't.
And still 5 months to go. The Mullins decided this would be their year off the hamster wheel of consumerism after trying it out a month at a time last year. But it was the holidays that finally kicked things off.
I was ready. I mean, I was partly because the consumption that happens around Christmas is so overwhelming, and you always feel like you need to, like, purge. And so that's why I thought it would be so easy. And then, of course, the regular year starts, and then you get into the year, and birthdays happen. And
can you give me a jar of water?
A jar of water? Why do you need a jar of water?
For Angie's husband, Terry, the motivation came from a slightly different source.
I get disgusted looking at catalogs where there's so much frivolous stuff. Your grandparents used a marshmallow on a stick. It wasn't like this fancy self-rotating, you know, s'mores machine.
Angie says the family has broken the Compact a couple of times. They bought a new coloring book for the kids to take on a camping trip. And Terry bought some new camping equipment, and they bought a new heater for the house. But Angie got to the point where she felt guilty about those small purchases. And about halfway through the year, she started to feel deprived.
But I know it's absurd, because I know we are not deprived if you look at world standards of income, I have to remember that. But, you know, I mean, we need little things like a handle for the door in the backyard.
It seems like a handle for a door would be a necessity. How have you gone about making that determination?
There have been times when my husband and I have disagreed about that. He thought that the handle was a necessity, and I didn't think it was. Okay, here's another one. We got a sandbox, a used sandbox from a friend, so we need to get some sand for it. And I ended up just going to Home Depot, and I knew that when I was doing it, I was being bad. But I just, I could go to the beach, but that's not really fair. I mean, it's not. I can't steal sand from the beach. And
apparently, Henry agreed. And Terry agreed that the experiment hasn't been easy. It's delayed gratification, he says. It slows you down. You're not fixing things as fast as you could if you had the latest new tools.
But I think you get more enjoyment out of the process because you really feel like you're crafty, you know. You're doing it the old way. That's the question you always come back to. Is like, well, what did my grandparents do before they had the gadget that they could just buy off the shelf that would do this fancy thing?
You know what? We're not going to do anything messy like that right now.
The lack of shopping as an entertainment option has had some definite upsides, too. It's meant more trips to the beach, just a few blocks away, and more family hikes and a lot of time in the backyard. Another benefit of not setting foot in a Target all year? The Mullins have noticed the experiment is helping pad their bottom line.
Because you know what? I know when I go there, I'm going to spend money that I don't need to spend, so.
And when's the last time you escaped a big box store for less than $50 or $100? Bills are paid sooner than they used to be, and credit cards are in hibernation. And to critics who harp that if everybody did this, the consumer economy would tank.
The truth is, you know, our money is still in the economy. We're still buying things. We're just not buying them new. But I do think it's important for people to think about the level of consumption they're part of and to try to curb some of that. I think it's just out of control.
Play with the broom while you're standing up.
The Mullins say they'll try to keep the experiment going through the end of the year. So far, so good. Ask yourself, could you do it? Join the conversation about American consumerism at our website, marketplace.org. Click on Consumed. You can give and get tips and ideas on how to cut your own consumption. And we also have photos of the Mullen family. You can also see some dolls Angie handmade for 5-year-old Daphne to give out as birthday presents instead of buying shiny new toys for her friends. After the break, more of our special program, Consumed. We're dedicating the entire show to the question of whether our consumer culture is sustainable. Up next, who needs trash? They do.
We have Walmart prisons and now landfills coming. But it's jobs. So bring it on. Because you just don't see the big-time business park developments and private developers looking at our area.
And from your curb to another continent, do you know where your trash is headed?
Cat food, Boost, Bud Light, Huggies, diapers, Coca-Cola, fabric softener, Diet Coke, antibacterial multi-surface cleaner trigger. I feel like I'm home.
That's right. All this trash traveled 7,000 miles from America.
There's money behind the global trash trade. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. We're back with more of Consumed, a special series on this and other American Public Media programs. What's so wrong with trash? That's the question we're asking this week. Many of you know I got a very personal answer to that question a few weeks ago. As part of this series, I carried my trash around with me everywhere I went for 2 weeks. In a word, yuck. I challenged you, dear listener, to join me, and many of you did. Sue Ann Ramella is a public radio host in Pullman, Washington. She took the challenge for 1 week back in September.
I've been hanging out with a lot of hippie friends lately, so I thought this would be a great way to see what the life is like through their eyes.
For her, the biggest challenge of the challenge was having to think about what she was throwing away 24/7.
When you're at the grocery store, all of a sudden you're faced with, should I buy this tuna because it's in the nice little aluminum packaging, or should I buy it in the can? Sometimes you're just lazy, and it's like a luxury just to not even think about it and throw something in the garbage can just to get rid of it.
But the challenge did do its job, forcing Sue Ann to change some habits.
I use, personally, a lot of paper products, like tissues and paper towels, and so much so that I decided to switch to cloth napkins, and now I use a hanky. In a weird way, you know, doing this trash challenge has just shown me how much I buy and how much of that isn't necessary.
Another challenge participant, Andrew Lane of Athens, Georgia, prides himself on already being a model citizen when it comes to trash.
I've often earned the name Earthman, or my favorite is Captain Planet.
Captain Planet is also a captain in the Army National Guard. And Andrew Lane said he's been a dedicated recycler for years.
Whenever we would go on runs at Fort Stewart, Georgia, I would always carry a grocery bag with me and pick up a few cans and bottles along the way.
But fellow soldiers made sure that did not happen while he was stationed in Iraq.
I said, no, we've got to get you out of this habit because of the IEDs and the threats over there. They like to camouflage bombs in trash.
But back stateside, without those kinds of restrictions, Lane had plenty of confidence he'd have no trouble with the challenge.
I can easily put my 2 weeks' worth of trash in a Walmart-size normal shopping bag.
Now, how do you do that? Because not everything is recyclable.
It's not, and that's actually what I have in my bag, which is over there attached to my backpack. I opened a mouthwash today for my son, and of course that little safety seal wrapper I don't know quite what to do with.
We spoke when he was on day 10 of his challenge, and Lane said even with all his recycling experience, it was eye-opening to haul around his garbage instead of tossing it out.
You just put it in a little bag and on the curb, and the garbage truck comes. You never have to think about it again. But it is staggering how much we throw away. Everything is disposable.
Kelsey McDonald is another challenge participant. We checked in with the Claremont College student just as she ended 1 week of carrying her trash around the Southern California school. I asked her to list what was in her bag.
I have a lot of coffee cups, paper coffee cups, and some rotting apples and celery, tissues. Mostly the fruit starting to smell a little rank, and the whole thing's moist and yucky.
Yes, there are compost bins on the far ends of campus, but sometimes she just didn't make it there. Her lessons echo those of Sue Ann and Andrew.
It's made me think much more critically about what I do with every single little thing. It's made me, I'm going to start my own little compost bin in my room and just haul that out once a week instead of for every single little meal I have, and it's totally convenient.
Good luck to the roommate. But there, McDonald does hit on one big key to reducing our waste stream, make it at least or even more convenient to recycle something than throw it away. We've got a link to Sue Ann's blog and a photo of Andrew next to a pile of plastic containers at Fort Stewart. It's all at marketplace.org. Click on Consumed.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation. Online at kauffman.org.
One of the big problems facing our buy it and toss it culture is that we're running out of places to put all that trash. As we mentioned earlier, landfills are closing. And in most places, the not in my backyarders are vocal opponents against new ones. But believe it or not, some places actually want our garbage. The U.S. imports trash from Canada and hazardous waste from Mexico. Why? Money. A report from the Congressional Research Service shows more than 42 tons of municipal solid waste crossed state lines for disposal in 2005. Pennsylvania is the country's biggest trash importer, so we sent Marketplace's Amy Scott to a town in the central part of the state where local officials are actually fighting to bring trash to their community. And she got an earful.
We need the jobs.
50 years ago, Pat Cutrio worked as a truck driver hauling coal in Pennsylvania's Moshannon Valley. But the mines shut down in the 1980s. And recently, as a supervisor of Rush Township, Cutrio voted to bring in a private landfill, incinerator, and industrial park. He says the project could bring dozens of jobs to the area and up to $3.5 million a year in fees to the township government.
Our school district is hurting. It's like $1.5 million in debt. We need this landfill.
Communities throughout Pennsylvania have made the same calculation. As cities like New York have closed their own landfills, an interstate garbage trade has thrived. Pennsylvania imports more trash from out of state than any other state in the country, more than 9 million tons of it last year. Stan LaFuria directs the Moshannon Valley Economic Development Partnership. He says as the local mining industry collapsed and textile jobs headed overseas, the region has turned to businesses people generally don't want in their backyards.
We have Walmart, prisons, and now landfills coming. But it's jobs, so bring it on, because you just don't see the big-time business park developments and private developers looking at our area.
Plenty of local residents would prefer the area remain overlooked. About half a mile from the proposed landfill site, Terry Burbage surveys an old railroad tunnel from the coal mining days. Hikers and ATV riders frequent the abandoned rail bed.
They'll be able to smell it. They'll be able to see it. This is very, very close.
Burbage and her husband moved here about 3 years ago to escape the bustle of Pittsburgh, only to find out their little mountain community might become the dumping ground for cities hundreds of miles away. The landfill developer says some of the garbage is likely to come from out of state.
We have all of this to offer, and this is our mountains, so why are we taking New York trash?
The main reason might actually be profit. Heather Rogers wrote the book Gone Tomorrow, The Hidden Life of Garbage. She says in the 1960s and 70s, private haulers like Waste Management began buying up local landfills. Today, just a handful of multinational corporations handle most of our waste. Rogers says to maximize efficiency, they've built ever larger regional megafills. And to maximize profits, those landfills seek garbage from farther and farther afield.
This exporting is not happening because it makes sense environmentally. It's not happening because it's creating jobs in rural areas. It's happening because it makes economic sense for these corporations to run their facilities in this way.
Landfills may be better neighbors than they were a few decades ago, but they still tend to end up in communities that are poor or rural or otherwise less politically powerful, places like Rush Township. Some people say that's unfair, but Vivian Thompson says it's not that simple. She teaches environmental science at the University of Virginia.
I had a student who came from one of these very communities in eastern Virginia with a mega landfill.
Thompson has written a book about the interstate trash trade.
And in our discussion about this particular issue, he said, I wouldn't be at the University of Virginia if it weren't for the landfill that came in and that gave revenues to our community so that we could build new schools. I wouldn't be here. So what's fair?
At a recent township meeting, Supervisor Pat Cutrio asked the same question. The landfill project he's pushing hinges on a new exit off of Interstate 80. And so far, the county government has blocked plans to build it, despite local appeals.
They have in their head that this township, not just us, but everybody over here in Center County on this side, just doesn't count. That's all there is to it. Gee whiz, what are we, a bunch of hillbillies?
Meanwhile, Rush Township continues to export its own trash to Somerset, Pennsylvania, about 100 miles away. In Rush Township, Pennsylvania, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
Up next, exporting paper trash across the Pacific Ocean. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. So, yes, the U.S. actually imports trash from its neighbors, but we export it as well. And this next story closes that loop in spectacular fashion. But first, generate for yourself a mental picture of a pile of garbage. It's probably got all kinds of gross stuff in it. But in reality, 35% of our waste is simple paper and paper products like cardboard. Sad when you think of how easy it is to recycle that stuff. But when it is recycled, you won't believe where it goes. We asked our correspondent halfway around the world, Scott Tong, to go do a little dumpster diving in China. Scott, what'd you find?
Hi, Tess. On a tip, I started my trash hunt in the port city of Taicang outside Shanghai. I had my eye on a big orange shipping crate as it got plucked off a ship and deposited on a truck bound for a nearby paper recycling mill. There, we opened the container and feasted our eyes on 2,000 cubic feet of paper trash, i.e. slimy old boxes. The labels read like a mile-long consumer hangover.
Cat food, Boost, Bud Light, Huggies, Diapers, Coca-Cola, fabric softener, Diet Coke, antibacterial multi-surface cleaner trigger. I feel like I'm home.
That's right. All this trash traveled 7,000 miles from America. What's it doing in China? Well, it's the very profitable idea of a woman named Zhang Ying. She's chairman of a Hong Kong paper recycling behemoth. It's called Nine Dragons. Zhang is part of a new generation of self-made billionaires in China. She started with nothing, growing up in China's hardscrabble rust belt in the 1950s and 60s.
My father was in the military. His salary was very low, and he had to feed 8 children. As far as food, we hardly ever had meat.
Zhang is 50. She's a small person with a big voice and a very big diamond ring. Her net worth is $10 billion, all from the garbage trade. Zhang got into waste paper in the 1980s, just as China was ditching the planned economy in favor of a free market.
In the 80s and 90s, China went through a giant change. It needed all resources. At the time, I was in the recycled paper business, and I realized the China market was a blank slate.
Since China didn't have enough trash of its own, she went elsewhere to find trash. Remember Oscar the Grouch from Sesame Street?
Oh, I love trash.
Zhang first collected in Hong Kong, traipsing from one landfill to the next. And then she went big time to the promised land of human consumption, America, where the streets are lined with gold in the form of trash.
I went to the U.S. for business because I thought America was a big consuming country, though it's not an over-consuming country.
Okay, that's debatable. Tamara Stark of the nonprofit Greenpeace thinks it makes sense that a Chinese company got into recycled paper early on. China just doesn't have the trees to make enough brand new paper.
In countries such as the United States or Canada, we're still blessed with quite a large amount of natural forest. In the case of China, much of those forests were logged out centuries ago, and so it's forced companies like Nine Dragons to look at our resources in a different way.
Back at the paper recycling plant, that American paper trash is dumped into a big vat of hot water, which splashes all over me. Now, remember, this is dumpster material that's been on a boat for weeks. Suddenly, the folks near me aren't so near me anymore. Anyway, the old boxes get shaken and stirred, stretched and filtered, and then they're put through a series of high-tech drying processes. It's almost all mechanical. This is no cheap Chinese labor story. Nine Dragons own state-of-the-art German and Scandinavian machines.
They've become the premier exporters of recovered paper in the world.
Independent paper analyst Bill Moore explains how a recycling company can make so much money. It has the newest, most efficient technology. It has scale. And believe it or not, it gets low, low shipping rates across the Pacific. That's because the Chinese ship everything to America, and the Americans send far less back.
We have a glut of empty containers here in the States that have to go back to the countries that are filling them. So shipping old corrugated boxes from Los Angeles to China is actually less expensive than shipping them from Los Angeles to Las Vegas.
He says it also doesn't hurt that Ms. Zhang has joined an exclusive Communist Party advisory body. Translation, friends in high places. One other advantage is that Nine Dragon factories burn coal, which is dirtier but cheaper than the natural gas that some competitors use. Toward the end of the trash reincarnation process, giant sheets of brown paper get blow-dried and stored on rolls. The paper then gets twisted and bent into cardboard, which gets twisted and bent into boxes. Who buys these boxes? You know the names.
So shop Office Depot today.
Panasonic, ideas for life.
Philips Television.
Of course, these Western companies make their stuff in China, so the recycled shipping boxes are made in exactly the right place. At the end of our factory tour, stamping machines are putting manufacturer logos on the boxes. In fact, one stack is stamped ahead back across the Pacific. Your recycled trash test is coming to a store near you.
Sure enough, armed with a photo Scott sent me, I came to my local big box store, and here in the toy aisle, I reconnected with what very well could be my recycled trash. It's a Nine Dragons box holding a child's bike. The carton is made of recycled paper that's literally been on the slow boat to China and back.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Our special series on the consumer economy continues across this and six other American public media shows. Next week on the Marketplace Morning Report, we'll shine a spotlight on the runway, where clothing trends are gone.
Every individual has to do a lot more work to stay current. It's like a treadmill where we just sped up, but we're all just staying in place.
And on Marketplace, we're headed back in time to take a look at how one company drove up consumer demand and changed the way marketers butter up American shoppers.
Keep cooking with Crisco. It's digestible.
All of this really gave women a new role in society, particularly as consumers.
And don't forget to check our website. You can post a comment about our series and also find more details about our look at the consumer economy. Just visit marketplace.org and click on Consumed. Marketplace Money's Consumed special was produced by Margaret Koval and Nancy Fargali. Margaret was also our editor. James Richter engineered. Special thanks to Stephen Gregory and our regular staff, John Haas, Rico Galliano, and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, working to provide tools and expertise to help you meet your retirement goals and ultimately thrive in retirement. Let's thrive. On the web at thrivent.com/retirement.
American Public Media.